What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of comic books that have come out this week. Whether it's Tuesday or Wednesday, it doesn't matter. We still just love comics. We love talking about them.
I think it does. Days of the week do matter.
Not true.
No, not currently, Pete.
Yep.
Name the day. Name the day really quick, fast, wrong. Thursday. 6-9, exactly. 69. That's always on your mind.
Hey, Pete. Nice.
Aw, you're fucking creepy, man.
I'm the creep. You're the one who said 69, Pete.
No, I said June 91.
Yeah, all right. Try to pass it off now. Tell you what, let's get into it. Let's talk about the comic books instead of talking about what a creep Pete LePage is.
Oh, exactly. Man. That guy's the weird one.
Adventure Man number one from Image Comics, script by Matt Fraction, pencils and colors by Terry Dodson, and inks by Rachel Dodson. So this is a, as you can probably figure out, entirely new title from Matt Fraction and the Dodson. So it's a powerhouse team. I got to tell you, first of all, this book is great. Second of all, I spent the first half of this book being like, what's the twist? What are you doing? What's the twist here? Come on, give me the twist. And thankfully, it did come halfway through. I'm not 100% sure if we want to spoil it. I guess we'll get there. But I was so happy when it did come, and I love where this title is going. And even more than that, I love Matt Fraction's explanation of how the title came about in the back matter. I'm very much on board with this book. What do you guys think?
I mean, it's beautiful. I didn't understand what was happening for a lot of it, but I'm glad it kind of like at the end slowed back down a little bit so we can kind of like build from there, because it was a lot at once and then kind of all over the place, and then was like, okay, this is where we're going to start from. So I was like, okay, cool. Moving forward, we can work with this. I think it does a great job of being like, look at this fucking insane world that we'll get to again, but we're going to kind of start slow. So, I mean, obviously the art's amazeballs, but this is, this is an interesting book.
I really like this. To what you're saying, like, it very much starts in a world of like the shadow type hero and the type of heroes he would have around him. And a great epic battle, beautifully done by the Dodsons. And then you get a total pivot in the center to something that is super interesting and detailed. And I'm very curious to hear or to see like where it spins, because it doesn't exactly go where you expect. It sort of takes a little bit of a different direction. So I'm really on board with this.
Yeah.
Also, you should pay attention when someone walks in your store, you know, look up. You know?
Sure.
See who's walking in your store.
Yeah, that's a very specific plot point that you're calling on. I think the best way of describing it, or one way of describing it at least, is like Doc Savage meets the Neverending Story is what it struck me as.
What?
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Wait, what? What do you mean, what, Pete?
There's no fucking flying dragon in this.
Not yet, but spoiler
show
time.
Me a fucking Falcor and then you can say Neverending Story. There's no fucking rock monsters like these hands look like strong hands. That doesn't happen.
Sure, right? There's no that drowns or anything like that.
Yeah, there's
no part
where it's like, holy shit, it's on us. We're reading this story. We got to save the day.
I guess Alex was wrong when he said this is a book that is exactly the Neverending Story.
That's where he made a mistake.
That was his mistake.
It has elements of both of those things,
I think
it's very well done. I mean, to the crazy point, the thing that Matt Fraction talks about at the end of the book, which I think is so different for him and I'm so excited to see, is he says, based on this concept, he realizes anything can happen in this world. And that's what it feels like, that basically he just started writing and is going to see where it takes him and then try to make it all link up by the end. And that, to me, is the ethos of serial storytelling, like literally from like serial movies where it's, we're writing a chapter, then we're going to write the next chapter, then we're going to write the next chapter. We'll see what happens. Maybe it'll tie up at the end. Or even like Charles Dickens writing word by word and seeing where he gets to. that's great. And that's so freeing for him, particularly for a creator that's like, so like you look at the Jimmy Olsen book where it's told 12 issues told insanely out of order that's slowly coming together over the course of this. This must be so freeing and wonderful for him. And you could feel the lightness throughout the book.
Wait, so you're saying Charles Dickens was like, okay, I'm going to start with the, and let's see, no idea beyond that. I'm going to go with hat. Okay, so we have the hat, and then we're going to go with danced. Let's go with danced. The hat danced.
You played the exquisite quirks game. That's how he wrote his books. He had an improv group, and then he wrote down whatever they said.
Wow. It was funny that he had the original, because obviously everyone credits him as the original founder of improv, who moved to New York with the Charles Dickens Four, and then created their signature.
My favorite book by Charles Dickens is Truth in Comedy.
Yeah, that's true.
Charles Dickens?
Dickens?
Yeah.
Dickens. I don't know. Yep. Anyway, this book is great. Definitely pick it up. Next one up from Marvel Comics, New Mutants number 10, written by Ed Bryson and art by Flaviano. This is taking place in an Eastern European country. A new mutant has gotten kind of crazy, created a bubble that takes everybody into their nightmares, and the New Mutants are trying to work on it. Meanwhile, outside, the humans are like, oh, this is fake news. We're... Nah, this is mutant propaganda, and that's basically what's going on. Pete, you raise your hand. What's going on?
Yeah, oh, man. Wasn't it nice for the X-Men just to get off Fuck Island and get back into the world and, like, do things and, like, have an adventure that didn't involve some kind of fucking bullshit island? I fucking love this. It was nice to have this comic back and doing things that aren't just weird Fuck Island shit. I was very excited about this issue.
Let me just say, Pete, if you've ever been to Fuck Island, you don't want to leave. You're not going to, you're going to regret leaving Fuck Island.
Yeah. I like this book as well for different reasons than Pete.
But oh, really? I think, different than that?
Yeah, different than that. I like taking a weird mutant power and spinning it out and seeing where it goes. I like the propaganda aspects of the storyline where you have the prime minister of this country being like, come on, they're just faking this, which feels very on the news today. And very current to
did
me.
Did you like the recipe stuff? Did you like the cooking tips?
I did like the recipe, and yeah, I'll tell you too. What, I want to make that.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. What is it?
It was like a vegetarian stew. It had a very specific name, but it was Glob's Vegetarian Stew. So, you know, good stuff.
Cool. Yeah, I like this a lot. This felt like sort of classic X-Men stuff, still using all of the current continuity. Like, I like the way they're like, oh, man, Wildside's here. Who wants Wildside?
There's a lot of shit on Wildside.
Well, Wildside's like a villain, sort of a shitty laksa, Glob's vegetarian laksa recipe. Wildside's like a shitty, I think, mutant liberation front villain who like was just a henchman.
Yeah,
basically.
Because of the new status quo of villains, there's no villains or heroes. It's just all mutants living on Fuck Island. So
That's a reality show that I hope happens.
Fucking live with it. You got Wildside now.
I like it. That's why I said I liked it.
Me too. All right, next up, X-Men Fuck Island number 92. Great issue. Lots of fucking.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Right. Still got it.
Batman number 2 from DC Comics, written by James Tynion IV and art by Gillum March. This is finally bringing Punchline, the heavily hyped Punchline, into the fray, going up against Harley Quinn and Catwoman as Batman is tracking down both the Riddler and the Designer, who have been going up against him. Just another great issue of this book. James Tynion is knocking it out of the park.
Yeah, this is so great. Just the whole thing of like Catwoman being like, Harley, this, you know, like just the build up to the Punchline Harley Quinn kind of showdown, and then just kind of like sitting in for a minute before they start fighting. That was great. And then just love the Batman Riddler stuff. This is a real fun book, and there's a lot of layers to all the things going on. So it's exciting to see how this is all going to unfold and how Batman's going to deal, because while this whole designer thing that's happening, also the Joker's got a plan that hasn't been revealed yet. So there's some great stuff going on.
Yeah, James Tynion is such a great I feel like he is just a meticulous writer, and the way in this his Batman writing so far has he moves the chess pieces down the board like just so that's not a great analogy. He like pushes the car down the road.
Shuffleboards?
No, I don't. What a game where you have to push multiple things down the board at the same time. Like he moves
Frogger?
Them all. Yeah, Frogger. He moves every little piece a little bit each issue in such a smart way while still having great big fun moments like the Harley punchline confrontation here. And I want to give a shout out to Guillaume March's art, who does a great job. I almost thought it was two separate artists on this, but the different styles on the Harley punchline stuff versus the Batman Riddler stuff is so great. It's so cool to see the stretching in those two different directions in the issue.
Also, I'm excited about Punchline. I like the way that they've dealt with her. Like, at first it was like, all right, her name's Punchline. But
she clearly takes comedy seriously.
Yeah, yes. It's fun to kind of I'm excited for more with her. I think this could be a very exciting new villain.
I still need to be sold on Punchline, I think. There's a very telling thing in there where Harley Quinn is like, listen, babe, in a couple of years, let's go have margaritas and just kind of chat about everything. And that, to me, felt like a very meta reference to, we'll see if you last as a character. Let's see what happens.
Well, I don't know, man. I think you put your own shit on that. I think that was just kind of like, hey, you know, I've also dated the Joker, and we can kind of like dish and, you know, kind of gripe or whatever.
I don't know. Why don't we have Harley Quinn confront the other version of Harley Quinn that also exists in the DC universe? Because right. It definitely feels like fully in that pattern of like, okay, here we go again.
Yeah. But we'll see what happens. Again, I still need to be convinced of her, but I certainly...
Fuck you, man.
I'm, oh my God, all in the tank for Punchline already. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, it's just, you know, you just being like, I'm not convinced of, but fuck you.
That was right? An amazing...
You don't have to be convinced of anything, all right?
That was an amazing impersonation of me, Pete. I felt I was listening to myself just there, so thank you.
And let's not move past the fact that Pete is famously always convinced about everything in comic books.
Yes.
That's a good point.
Let's move on to talk about one of my favorite books right now, Stealth Number 2 from Image Comics, written by Mike Costa and art by Nate Belgrade, Mel Belgard, excuse me. So the first issue of this book set up, it was a swerve, like it was a twist first issue where you thought there was this young superhero who was going out on the streets, being a vigilante, taking care of his dad, trying to balance so many things. Turns out it's his dad who has some serious memory issues and maybe some serious mental issues going on, who is actually vacillating between beating up criminals and beating up the cops. We deal with the fallout this issue. We meet the big bad villain that's coming for both of them. I got to tell you, like, I was very hyped up after the first issue. This matched it. And to me, at least in the early going, feels like this is like the next Invincible in my mind.
Wow. Yeah,
that's a big statement, but I agree. Like, I love this book. Like, it's a book that had a nice swerve, but it didn't feel like a gimmick. It felt earned in the first issue. And the second issue, like, sort of elaborates on the premise, but also just, like, builds on the characters away from the premise and introduces a villain that was, like, great, scary. Like, it's very rare when you get a visual reveal like you get in this issue and it really hits, and it just did, I thought.
And plus, what's great is it goes back to that old adage, if you rub a creepy hand on somebody's face, they'll tell you their whole life story from start to finish.
God, if I hear that one more time, Pete, I'm going to scream. That old
cliche.
Adage.
Cliche.
Well, do some vocal warm-ups because you be screaming. I think that the art's great. This is a fun kind of book that's like aware of tropes and doing different things and making different choices. I'm very interested to see how this all pans out, but so far I'm on board.
I always hate hearing that trope, do some vocal warm-ups because you be screaming, but here we go, Pete trotting out that old chestnut one more
time. Dusted that one off.
Yeah.
Wellington, number 4 from IDW, story by Aaron Mankey and Delilah S. Dawson, script by Delilah S. Dawson and art by Piotr Kowalski. This is a book with a lot of rabbits.
And the rabbits are cool.
Yeah.
It's scary. Yeah. We saw a lot of rabbits in our stack today, I want to say.
The art alone is worth it, the pickup for this. I mean, the panel layouts, the use of color, the lack of color, the way they're kind of do full page spreads into single, very small stuff. Very impressive. The artistic style in this comic is very impressive. Then it kind of gets into like white people shit with the tea and the fucking bullshit. And I have a robot butler. But I'm interested to see where it goes.
Man, I have some bad news for you about your melanin, Pete.
Wow. Big pause. I like this. It felt, I think the rabbit stuff, was great. It does feel like sort of proper British. Maybe that's what Pete is talking about a little bit. But I liked it.
Yeah. Delilah S. Dawson does a good job with horror fantasy. And I think that's on display here. I haven't read the first three issues of this book, but I like this. It's creepy. It's weird. It's interesting. Definitely intrigued to pick up more. Let's move on to another book that I'm going to give insane over praise to. Dryad number 2 from Oni Press, written by Curtis Wiebe and illustrated and colored by Justin Osterling. In the first issue, we were introduced to a couple that moves to a small town in a fantasy-style world. They establish that magic has pretty much left the world, even though it seems like a very typical Tolkien-esque fantasy world. Years later, we pick up with their kids exploring the woods. They seem to release demons in the woods, and we pick up right there. There's a bunch of twists this issue. And while I'm giving overpraise to some of the best comics of all time, this to me, again, in the second issue, and I know it's ridiculous to throw this out there, feels like the new Saga to me.
100%. What the fuck, dude? Jesus Christ.
We compared it to Saga with the first issue, and like in a time when Saga is not coming out, like if you're a Saga fan, this definitely fills that gap, but it's not, to Alex's point, it's not just a filler. This has legs. It's not a Saga clone by any means. It's a bit of praise because it really has that same vibe of like strong, like irreverent characters that feel real, but feel like they have real voices in a fantasy / sci-fi world a little bit that are out there. Like you want to know, you get caught up in the drama very quickly. And I want to also shout out the art by, you said Justin Osterlinger, like so good, really on the same level as Saga as well.
I mean, who doesn't love a badass mom? And I think that this comic has that, and I think it's great. I really like this world that they set up. I'm excited to get more. There was some some sexual stuff like they have in Saga. But I'm excited to see where this goes and what's going on. I mean, so far we don't have like a Lion Cat or like one of those characters that is just so amazing. But I do think it could get there. That does have the potential for that.
Well, what do you love about Lion Cat the most? The fact that it says lying when people are lying?
Yep.
Checks out.
Interesting. There is just a hell of a twist in the middle of this second issue, which is a crazy thing to throw out there in the middle of a second issue, but highly recommend picking up the first one. Highly recommend picking up the second one. Definitely go back and check it out. Justin Osterling, by the way, is the name.
Osterling.
Daredevil number 20 from Marvel, written by Chip Zdarsky and art by Marco Cicchetto. Daredevil has the mask back on. Otherwise, he's pretty business casual other than that. He is fighting in the middle of Hell's Kitchen.
Party up top, business in the bottom.
Exactly. All of his villains are there. They are wrecking the shit out of Hell's Kitchen. Everything is coming together here. This is the knockdown, drag-out brawl for Hell's Kitchen issue. God, this is good. Just like Kingpin and Daredevil back to back being
back
like
to back.
Being like, fuck you. No, fuck you. Let's save Hell's Christian. No, I hate you. No, I hate such good characterizations throughout this entire book.
Yeah, I mean, Chip Zdarsky is like known as like a funny guy on Twitter, like very much like a jokester. But he has constructed just a very complex and delicate story for Daredevil throughout this whole series. And the fact that he's able to land in this issue, totally earned, Kingpin and Daredevil teaming up with not getting along, but having the same goal, I think is just really smartly done. Kingpin's like, I don't give a fuck about you. This is my city. I run this town. And Daredevil's like, this is Hell's Kitchen. This is my part of town. Like, that is just great. Typhoid Mary is in here. The Foggy does this great thing where he like shows up and Daredevil has to like
Foggy saves the fucking day is what he does. Foggy
Daredevil has to escort him out.
Day
he has
like
to
he
escort
always
him
does.
Out. Huh?
Foggy always says the day doesn't get any credit. Fucking gives the key at the key moment. Gives Daredevil the weapon he needs to save the day.
Yep, and then he has to slowly walk him out of Hell's Kitchen and get him back to a safe lazy boy to sit down and think about the law.
Fuck you. Fuck you, man. You gotta give Foggy
did either of you guys, not to get like too political or current on here, but did either of you guys reading this issue like seeing Kingpin fighting for Hell's Kitchen to be like, no, I gotta save this city? Did you think about Mayor de Blasio at all? Because I couldn't read this issue and
same
be
guy.
Like
same guy.
100%. Could you imagine de Blasio being like, I'm in the middle of a brawl fighting stuff? Because I can't.
Yeah. I want to say this was like...
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot you're in Philly now, Pete, so you don't care about our New York issues.
Yeah, come on. What about New York City?
First off, I don't think fucking... de Blasio and Kingpin, okay, all right, fine. But like the fact that de Blasio would roll up his sleeves and get in a brawl is just too ridiculous for me to even envision.
He works out at the Y all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Great for him. That's good for him. I also really liked the Zen moment that Daredevil had before he kind of like fought, like just the kind of the thing of like, breathe, you can do this. Like, it's very interesting the way Chip is kind of building Daredevil back up a little bit here. And also it was a weird turn at the end, but it's that classic thing at the end of comics where you're like, I don't know if this is real or not, or if they'll do this in the next issue.
Oh,
but
it's
like,
real. I think it 100% pays off Matt Murdock's guilt. I think it's definitely real, and we're going to see that in the next. That's the next arc, I bet.
But I do love how huge Kingpin is drawn in this comic. It's really fantastic, especially when it's like back to back with Daredevil. It was really cool.
He got into crime to afford the suits that he wears.
It's true.
You got to get a tailor.
You know what I mean? Because, Rochester Big and Tall is going to try to take care of you, but I don't know if they got stuff like that.
Oh, Pete, were you born in Rochester or were you born in Rochester Big and Tall? where are you from?
That's actually the only hospital that they have there.
Yeah, they only treat the biggest and tallest get medical assistance in Rochester.
Ian Fleming's James Bond number 5 from Dynamite, written by Vita Ayala and Danny Lohr, art by Brent Peoples. This to me, and I say this very fondly, is like Archer but serious.
That's funny.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that's a good take. What I like about it is specifically the art style feels very brushed. It feels like the covers of the original James Bond novels brought to life. I thought that was such a smart choice. And otherwise, it's a fun adventure. It's nice to see James Bond doing different stuff than he would normally be doing.
Yeah, it's great because it's like it's kind of going away from the trope of James Bond just being a womanizer. Like, we have female characters in here who are actually doing stuff and really being a part of it, and it's great to see like this kind of like a new dynamic and this direction. I like this kind of team up, and I also thought it was really cool the kind of showdown where she was like, oh, this all looks fake and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, I really thought this was... I'm not the hugest James Bond guy, but I thought this was a really great comic.
Huh. That's surprising to me.
You're more of an Austin Powers guy?
A Shagadelic baby?
I want my baby back, baby back, baby back.
Of course you would go for that. Undiscovered Country number 6 from Image Comics, written by Scott Snyder and Charles Soule, art by Giuseppe Comicoli and Leonard Marcello Grassi. This is the end of the first arc of this book. What? This,
finally, some clarity.
I'm sorry, Justin, go ahead.
I said finally some clarity.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it strung us along, and then in one issue, we get this huge info dump of all the stuff we've been wondering. It's like, holy crap. Yeah, intense. This is a really interesting, great comic that has, like, a lot happen in this issue. And if you stick with it this long, it's a great payoff.
This long being 6 issues.
Six issues, you got to wait.
If you haven't picked up the book, the idea is there is a plague called Sky that is hitting the entire world, killing off people. When there's a message from the United States, which has been walled off for years, summoning several people into the United States, it is not what they expected. Time moves differently there. There are different levels of walls, and they are trying to track down Aurora, which is, she is the mistress of the United States. She is the head of the United States. We don't know exactly what's going on with her yet, but they've been in the first area, which is run by an evil being called the Destiny Man. And it finally all comes down to this. They get through the first wall. As Pete mentioned, we get a lot of answers. Oh, God, I talk about this every issue, but like, there's so many things that I have such trouble wrapping my head around with this book, but it's so good nonetheless.
Yeah, it's like it sort of has the structure of a video game. You're like sort of moving through levels to get to the next level, but they don't explain. There are no cutscenes, or they don't explain a lot of what you're fighting and what you're fighting for. But I mean, we trust these writers. The art's great. I think we're going to get the story told, and it's ballsy to really immerse us in the world. But what I think they're striking is a really smart, simple tone. A lot of the characters are speaking in sort of American tropes, especially in this issue, which you get a lot of, and like sort of distilling dystopian or post-apocalyptic America down to values and sort of laying them out to us or these characters as they go through it is really cool.
I'm glad you said that video game thing, because I just want one of them to walk up to one of the villagers and ask a question about what's going on, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or like if eat some meat that's been sitting on the ground for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. To improve their stamina.
Mm-hmm. Mountain Head number 4 from IDW, story by John Lee's, art by Ryan Lee. I'll admit I haven't read the first 3 issues of this, so I don't know what's going on. I cannot, reading this 4th issue, imagine what happened to the first couple of issues, because, man, this issue is crazy.
Yes, it is. And the art is so detailed. It's like, I feel like it must have taken so long to draw this comic.
Yeah, this is a great comic as far as the art is concerned. The storytelling is fun, but it's really talking about an issue that I'm glad they're tackling. Don't trust people who are smiling and nice to you out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't do it. If you come across a town that's in the middle of a mountain and everybody's way too nice, get the fuck out of there.
So just to be more explicit about it, it's about a family that finds themselves on this mountain. Everybody gets infected with some sort of disease that turns them into horrible, pulsating flesh monsters. So it's kind of like a zombie invasion thing. They realize the only way out is over the mountain near the town. Again, I didn't read the first 3 issues. It's crazy to me that this is the 4th issue, because this feels like the first issue. So I feel like you could just pick this up and get going from here and not miss a beat, personally.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure the first 3 issues explain a little bit more about the town and what's going on.
What mountains are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like who the characters are.
What are they? I still don't know.
They're like fields that just go up.
Oh, okay.
They're like escalators that don't move.
Wow. I get it.
With trees.
The Batman's Grave, number 7 from DC Comics, written by Warren Ellis and art by Brian Hitch. This is continuing the most Warren Ellis Batman story you possibly can tell. Finally, there's like a bunch of things going on where some villains are attacking Batman. He's trying to figure out what's going on. There's a sequence where the Batmobile gets blown up and he has to walk home. It's just Warren Ellis like having fun with Batman and being like, Brian Hitch, you draw some crazy action sequences and have a good time. And it's so good.
We reviewed Next Wave in our live show podcast, and this feels a little bit like that in the relationship between the writer and the artist. It's very much like Warren Ellis doing wheelies on Batman conversations with like Commissioner Gordon, Alfred, all those, and then being like, all right, your turn, Hitch, you do some cool stuff, and we'll connect back at the tail end of the issue.
Yeah, this is it's really fun stuff. A lot of kind of like badass Batman moments, which is great. The whole car bit is hysterical. But it's too much for me because Alfred is dead. And like seeing Alfred here, and it's just like, it's great because it's like I get Alfred, but I know it's not in canon, it's not continuity, so it's just fucking like the fact that Alfred's here, but it's not real is fucking heartbreaking.
You know, they say real butlers never die, they just take longer making the tea.
Wow.
I love that old adage.
It's in a very old adage, butler turn of phrase.
Miles Morales, Spider-Man number 17, written by Saladin Ahmed, pencils by Carmen Carnero. Now, this is picking up on the outlawed storyline that started before coronavirus and then got put on hold and is now, I guess, being picked up again, where teen superheroes have been outlawed. They're supposed to be brought in by the U.S. government. And the first half of the issue is Spider-Man helping out a kid who feels like an outsider because he likes designing. He feels a little different than the other kids. And the second half of the issue is him being hunted down by Dum-Dum Dugan. I really like the first half of the issue in particular. Yes.
Oh, don't you fucking put it in halves.
I agree.
You like the comic or you don't.
I loved the first half, and I put it down and took a long break in between halves, which is what you're supposed to do with comics.
Nope.
There's a like a football game. It's like a halftime.
This was a great comic. I enjoyed this. I really like the kind of moment where he kind of checks in with the kid. I feel like that's a great Spider-Man thing to do.
Yeah.
Just be like, hey, man, you're awesome. Don't fucking sweat it. Like, follows him on Instagram, makes a video with him. Great Spider-Man shit. Love it. And then just fun.
So you,
like,
you love the first half.
Would you let me finish? Yep. And then running into Dum-Dum, that was fun. That was cool banter. And then him just kind of like sizing up Dum-Dum, escaping, and then just like getting to school and realizing, oh, shit, this is still going on. This wasn't kind of like a one type of incident. This is kind of like, and then, you know, seeing his friends like stressed out about it. I love this Spider-Man. This is this is a fun Spider-Man book. I'm very much enjoying it.
What did you think about the halftime show, Pete?
There wasn't a halftime show.
Are you talking about when
they sat down
because
and had
we have the first
dinner
half
as a family?
No. There was the first half, and then there was the performance by Shakira, and then there was the second half.
Yeah. I love the Shakira.
Did you not get that in your issue?
You should.
Was it Shakira and J-Lo or just Shakira? What happened?
Just Shakira. It's not the Super Bowl. They couldn't afford J-Lo.
I agree. I like this issue a lot, and I really like the way there are a lot of differences between Miles and Peter Parker, even though they're both sort of in the Spider-Man mode. And what I like that they do here is Miles is very busy, but he's never doesn't have that sort of manic energy that Peter Parker always has, where he's like, "Oh no, I'm late for all this stuff." Like the scene where he goes and has dinner with his family, I thought it was so great, and they have a discussion. They have different points of view. He's able to just be there for the whole discussion without having to rush off and move on. And it just feels like a night, a real, it feels like Spider-Man, but it feels different in a good
way. Yeah, it's nice.
Let's talk about Ice Cream Man number 19 from Image Comics, written by W. Maxwell Prince, art by Martin Morazzo. I know I've been given a lot of effusive praise this episode, but this title is like the next Ice Cream Man.
Wow. Wow. Just in time for summer.
This issue is fucking fantastic.
Like, is this the best comic?
That's the thing, right? Like, the way that it sets a high bar, and then you're going, all right, well, this has got to be the best issue of the run. And then it goes above that and just kills it. I just can't talk enough about how it designs an issue from start to finish in a way that makes you want to reread it, examine it, look at what it's doing. It's so smart. It's deep. It does so many different things. And then you'll get another issue that's so completely different. It's really impressive. It's almost like they have a team of writers on this coming up with different ideas to do each issue. It's unbelievable.
Well, and what's great about this issue specifically, that's very emblematic for the whole series, is it's a horror comic, all standalone issues, and it attacks like sort of every, it attacks like horror, like real life horror, like a murder, or in this case, a suicide.
Yeah.
Then it, in so many of the issues, it elevates that and just shows how an everyday normal life is horrifying. And we get that here as well. And then in addition, we get like the metaphysical horror, which can sometimes be spun positively in this comic. In this case, yes, very rarely. But like just being able to do horror in three different ways and have the most horrible thing be the everyday life of the characters that we're touching on is,
oh my God,
it's so good. I think this is my favorite comic to read every month, whenever it comes out. And this issue is my favorite.
Really, because you're changed after reading it.
Yeah.
You're not the same person. And it's crazy because like the horror levels are so specific. And when you, I just can't, but then also they had the weird Uncle Pete shit. And I'm like, what the fuck?
That's
Is
you.
This like a never ending story situation where I'm in the story too? Like, what's going on?
I'm sorry, Pete. Was there a dragon? Was there a horse that died? I don't think this is a never ending story situation. I just don't think so.
I put that cookie out for you and you took it.
To give you,
I always take the
you listener folks, the broad overview of this particular issue, there's an overarching plot for Ice Cream Man, but this essentially functions as a done-in-one issue. I'm sure there will be themes and ideas that pay off in future issues, but essentially this is about a kid, or at least it starts off with a kid, who dresses up a ghost, pretends he's a ghost, so he's floating through life. He thinks he's invisible, and it follows him in three different periods throughout his entire life as he continues to be affected by the things that happened to him as a child and continues to think of himself as a ghost walking through his own life. The main thing that I took away from this issue that I think is rather remarkable about this comic is this book is at its best when it's dealing with aging now. Like, it started off being about horror. It started off being about, I don't know, just about all the horrible things that potentially could happen to people. But
Death and violence.
Yeah, the violence and just like these very done-in-one, like Tales from the Crypt almost, but elevated horror ideas. But the best issues have almost no horror elements to them other than the absolute horror of like our own inevitable deaths.
Yeah.
And
but it also starts with like a guide. Like, it's like a guide of, like, how to be a ghost.
Yeah, on top of that, it uses this old, the guidebook, which is like an old, like, sort of almost Boy Scout thing.
Yeah.
Like, it has that's another layer of horror on it where it feels like this dusty thing you found in your attic.
Yeah, yeah. And just, like, the way that we're watching the character kind of, like, see things and feel things, like, that whole thing where he's on the roof, like cleaning the gutter, you're like, oh God, oh no, no, not the bridge again. Like, it is just so well done.
It's so concise as well. It really is. It's the best comic out there.
It's fantastic.
Get yourself some ice cream.
Close second, potentially, Something is Killing the Children, number 7 from Boom Studios, written by James Todd IV, illustrated by Werther Del Arderia. This was just nominated for an Eisner. So don't undersell it. This is about a woman, girl, teen, kind of unclear how old she is in a small town. She's fighting monsters who are, of course, killing children. This issue, we get somebody else from the organization she is part of, comes up to the town she's in, is like, you're fucking everything up. You're doing it wrong. Here's what you got to do right. Man, every issue of this is just so good. I know we've already praised James Tynion on this podcast, but the art from Werther Del Daria is so good across the board. Every issue of this is great.
Yeah, and what's great is, like, even though it's the same writer, this book feels so different. And that's really a great mark of an amazing writer, where you don't know it's the same person. Like, the whole part where she's angry and then explains to the other agent why, so moving. So fantastic. Yeah, this is a really, really great book. It starts off, even the first issue, you're like, holy shit, this is going to be a great run. And it's really delivered on every issue.
Got nominated for an Eisner. I mean, come on. Yeah, it's really good. The art is good and scary. And it really goes for the horrifying things. Like, a bunch of this issue especially, like, you feel it as the characters are dealing with all of these children that were killed. Really,
yeah, the chain-smoking mom, holy shit.
Really great book.
The Kill Lock, number 5 from IDW, story and art by Livio Romandelli. Again, this is one that I haven't read the first couple of issues of, but big old fights throughout, really beautifully drawn. I wasn't in love with the story, since I didn't know exactly what was going on there, but the art is very gorgeous throughout.
It's really great art. It seems like some kind of robot fight club that we've stumbled across here. But I love the kind of passion, and then the guy is beaten down and does the spit in the other guy's face. That was fun. It's some intense action. It's very interesting storytelling, but the art's the real hero.
I like this a lot. I think it's four robots that are sort of paired together from different circumstances, paired together after they've been shunned by society for different reasons. It feels a lot like, if you're a fan of Descender or Ascender, very much in line with the robot characters of that, like Driller, who's a real killer. Like, that vibe is definitely here. And the story, I thought, was great. Like, you don't know much about these characters. You can, even though they don't have mouths, you can really feel what they're feeling. And the sacrifice at the end of the issue is just really great. Really well done.
That mainly reminded me that in the last issue of Ascender, which was months ago at this point, Driller showed up. Which is exciting.
Oh, can't my wait. God.
I'm so excited. Bitterroot, number 8 from Image Comics, created by David F. Walker, Chuck Brown, and Sanford Green. This takes place in a world where monsters are real. Folks are fighting those monsters. Pete, I know you're a big fan of this book. What do you think about this issue?
You want to talk about an award-winning book. This book is un-fucking believable.
Has it won awards?
An amazing issue. What's that?
Has it won awards?
Nah, it will. It will. Give it time.
Okay,
I see what you're saying. People are slow to catch on to this, but it's really fantastic. This issue is amazeballs. We kind of get the thing where the teams split up to kind of go their separate ways to kind of win the day. And we have these kind of people who are taken over and some kind of like virus, and they've got to give them one of two antidotes. And I just really love the art. Sanford Green is killing it on the art. The storytelling is fantastic. And the back matter on this book is amazing. It's just, they get into griots, which is, if you watch the Mark Twain, David Chappelle special, David Chappelle talks about griots and how the art of storytelling and stuff like that. And this book is just killing it on that front. There's a lot of history and heritage in this story. And they also, just the back matter alone is just worth it. But this is a really creative, really amazing book. I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, I agree. The amount of research in this book and the historical underpinnings to it, while still just having just a great story that touches on, like, that's horrifying at points, but also, like, there's a great, like, jazz interlude in this as well. Yeah. Like, it's a story that's firing on all cylinders the entire time. Really great.
Yeah.
Next up, Vampirella Red Sonja number 8 from Dynamite Comics, written by Jordi Belair and art by Drew Boss. So Red Sonja is lost in time. She's sent to the, I want to say, 1920s. Vampirella has been brainwashed into being a dancer at a club. She's going and rescuing her. We talked about, I feel like, the first issue of this book, maybe the second, and that was pretty much it. But this is very good. Like, I think Jordi Belair drills in on these characters very well. The art by Drew Moss is great. I love all the 1920s skidoo type dialogue that happens throughout it. I'm not a huge fan of either Red Sonja or Vampirella, but this comic is good.
Yeah, what I really like what they're doing is they're not doing the TNA and all that bullshit. They're really going all in on the storytelling and focusing on these characters and the bond that they have, which is great. And it's a fun, cool story that involves these characters, and you don't know what's going to happen. There's so many twists and turns and so many different levels to stuff. But yeah, I think this is really impressive, and I'm glad they're kind of going away from just being like, hey, teenage boys, check out some TNA, you know, and they're doing some great storytelling.
Yeah, but I also, I think there is, like, sensuality or sexuality is mixed up, especially with these characters, so the fact that they... the story gets to that in a way that actually feels like it's part of the story and is interesting, as opposed to just like super obvious and there just to titillate. Like, I think that's really smartly done here. And yeah, it's a really great, like, they're sort of falling through time aspect of this comic is great. I liked it a lot as well.
Next up, Excellence, number 7 from Image Comics, created and written by Brandon Thomas and created in art by Cary Randolph. We've talked about, I think, every issue of this book, but
almost, yeah.
In case you haven't picked it up yet, it takes place in a world where there's a secret society of magical people. They are all black, and one of the people in the society is rebelling against it, rebelling against the sort of, like, caste levels of the society where women are locked off, different people are on different levels. This issue basically is trying to, like, set up his revolution, but check in with everybody beforehand. So he uses a spell to split himself into four so he can visit four different places, throw the people who are pursuing him off of him, and also check in with the people he loves at the same time. I love how specific every single issue of this is with a different aspect of the magic in the book. It's so smart, and Cary Randolph's art is phenomenal.
Yeah, go ahead.
I agree. Like, in a world where you may be looking for something outside of the Harry Potter world.
Why would that be?
Just in case you maybe are aware of a reason to be like, oh, maybe Harry Potter is not all it's cracked up to be these days. Like, this is such a great thing, a story to dive into that uses those elements in a way that feels new and interesting, and the characters feel real.
Yeah, I like Justin was saying earlier, like, this does such a great job of moving chess pieces around in a way that is so smart, and it's entertaining to watch. Like, you're kind of watching magicians try to outsmart each other and kind of setting these little traps and stuff. And the art's phenomenal. It's great storytelling, and it's fun to see someone being like, you know what, fuck all your old ways. I'm trying to do something. I'm starting a fucking revolution. Get on board.
I feel like this is not obviously the end goal, because I love Brandon Thomas. I love Cary Randolph. I want them to keep doing these comics forever. But reading this book, I was like, please God, just somebody give this to Michael B. Jordan and him be like, let me just star in this movie or TV show or whatever.
Because it's
whatever.
Him. Drawn.
It's him. It's him. Yeah. It's so clearly him. And it's so clearly like, it's so much more than that as a comic book, but it's so clearly at the same time like, oh, just put this on screen. Like, this is a one-to-one in terms of what you could do. It's great. Lois Lane number 11 from DC Comics, written by Greg Rucka, art and cover by Mike Perkins. This is the penultimate issue of this run on Lois Lane. Not what you would expect from a Lois Lane book, I think, but she is teaming up with a bunch of folks to take down a villain called the Kiss, I believe, who has been targeting Lois Lane, among other people. She is teaming up with this other woman, and the setup... they figure out mostly everything, but the setup at the end of the issue is Lois Lane is about to lay it all out like the good detective reporter that she is. So unexpected the way this series went, but so good at the same time.
Yeah, this is really taking some great creative swings, and I love the direction it took. I love putting Lois Lane in this power position of being the badass that she is. But then kind of like, oh shit, maybe I made a mistake. It was really great. This is a fun book. Every issue is very enjoyable. Art and storytelling are solid. This is a great pickup.
I'm surprised by the way it went, especially when, the first like three or four issues felt like pretty straight, like, slightly political, commenting on, the culture and culture in the DC universe and all that, and now we're into some like pretty wild multi-dimensional magic shit. So the fact that you can do all this in one book is super exciting. I think this has been one of the most interesting titles DC's done in the last year, so I can't wait to find out what Lois has to say when it comes to answers.
By the way, I don't want to break the fourth wall here or anything, but Justin, do you have a bunch of like very loud crickets going on in the background?
Yes, I'm in the country and there's a window here and there's like frogs and birds and crickets. Yeah, right.
Great. Awesome. Great stuff.
Yeah, I can close the window. Or is
that's all right.
Is it nice and country?
It's nice.
It makes me feel like I'm out of the city, which would be the best thing. Decorum number 2 from Image Comics, words by Jonathan Hickman, art by Mike Huddleston. This book is bonkers.
Yeah.
There is a story, and I use the word story loosely, that's happening at the beginning of the issue so far that is talking about some sort of thing with crystal people in the universe or whatever. And then the majority of the story is taken up with a delivery girl who is taken in by an assassin and potentially becomes something more. Justin, I know you really like the first issue of this in particular. How'd you feel about the second one?
I mean, truly, this issue proves it even harder. Like, this is Jonathan Hickman being like, oh, I like what I did over here on X-Men. Where I have this sort of story and I do a bunch of different chapters and they all don't all connect necessarily. And then I do a bunch of like prosy things in the middle that are sort of infographic-y, but also just like little bits. What if I did that where I didn't have to follow any sort of continuity or have an editor tell me what the fuck I'm doing? And that's what this book is. This is truly his X-Men Krakoa style jam sesh, where he gets to go wild in the universe with a Kitty Pryde type character who is out there doing her own thing. And if you like the X-Men run that he's doing, this is like it cut loose.
I mean, as soon as it started with the symbols and all that stuff, I was like, come on, Hickman. You know, we know this is your fucking bag. You don't have to lean into it this hard. But I made a mistake because this is the part where it got all like Downton Abbey and the and the fucking robot butlers and stuff like that.
Great. Oh, thanks, Pete. You said that before about Wellington, you were actually talking about this book.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Rick and Morty Go to Hell, number 1 from OD Press, written by Wright and Ryan Ferrier, illustrated by Costanzo Orozco. Or is on. There we go. So this is exactly what it says for the title. This is Rick and Morty. If you're a fan of the TV show, they end up in hell. They're not quite sure why they're there or what happened. Of course, Rick does not believe they're in hell. Morty absolutely thinks they're in hell, and they work through from there. I think this is fun. I think this channels the sense of the show. There's some good bits throughout here. I enjoyed reading this book.
Yeah. I felt like it was very much, you know, felt like a Rick and Morty show in comic book form. The only thing that bothered me was the whole issue. Rick was like, nope, 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 not, you know what I mean? Like, come on, guy. Like, I got to read another issue before you're finally like, okay, we're in hell.
Could you imagine if there was an entire show where one of the characters on the show just said no and fuck you the entire time? That would be very disappointing for everybody. Right, Pete?
That's true. Really anti-improv.
Weird. I never thought about it like that.
Oh, wow. Sip. Drinking a beer. Kat, I wish you all could see this at home because it's
oh, my God. He's pouring. He's not even drinking. He's pouring it all on his face, all over his shirt. He's just like luxuriating in this beer.
Oh, my God. Now he's taking off his shirt because it's all wet, and he's kind of like rubbing it into his chest here. He's very hairy.
Very hairy. That beer goes all the way down.
What did you think about this one, Justin?
I mean, it's good. To your point, it feels, if you're a fan of the show, like Rick and Morty is a show that, and this is like sacrilegious a little bit, but I haven't watched it. It's a show that I haven't.
Really? Dude, what, all the free time that you have right now? What the fuck, man?
No, no free time. It's a show that I definitely want. I've seen a couple episodes, but I haven't really just committed to it.
Did you see Pickle Rick?
No, I know about pickles.
Overrated.
I know about pickles.
No. Pickle Rick is a very touching episode, you asshole.
It's a very good episode, but it's not the best episode of the show.
Yeah, but it's a famous episode.
Here's what I'd say is the one thing that hurts this is it's weird reading in a comic book form because they're trying to repeat the speed of the back and forth and the overlap of Rick and Morty, and it doesn't quite work in the comic book form. I think Ryan Ferrier does a good job of trying to ape it, and he mirrors it as much as possible, but you don't get that, like, even though it's Justin Roiland doing the voices, it's just they're overlapping and you don't get that there, which is a bit of a bummer. But in terms of the humor and everything else, it all tracked and I think it's good. Great. And Justin, you should watch it. You should check it out.
I'm definitely going to.
There you go. All right, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you'd like to support us, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday to Crowdcast and YouTube. Come hang out and we will chat comic books. Comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and more. iTunes, Android, Spotify, Stitcher, or the app of your choice to subscribe and listen. Pete, what did you want to say?
Well, just be careful if you choose YouTube or Crowdcast because apparently people are really into those specific platforms, so you can't just willy-nilly go back and forth. You got to choose a team or a side.
Yes, choose a side, whether it's YouTube, Crowdcast, or Team Frogs Outside the Window, and we will see you next week at the Virtual Comic Book Shop. And they let the secrets leak. And occasionally they fail.